few years ago, Catherine Coles was trying to come up with an idea for her symposium. Coles is an acclaimed poet and an English professor at the University of Utah. She co-directs the Symposium in Science and Literature at the U. And she was trying to figure out the right subject for the next one. She told us the idea has to be abstract enough so people from different disciplines will be interested, but it also has to hit home for an audience. In the past, they've had economists and writers, paleontologists and composers talking about imagination and restoration and building. But this time, Coles was drawing a blank until she went on a run. She was listening to a podcast, to the Sunday Read from the New York Times.
Read by MacLeod Andrews.
A male flame bowerbird is.
And the Sunday Read is about the question of beauty and evolution, and particularly this guy who studies birds, who's arguing that birds are beautiful only for purposes of sexual selection.
Biologists have favored the idea that beauty in the animal kingdom is not mere decoration, it's a code.
And I think about beauty all the time, and I had long been frustrated with the approach that attributed all beauty in the world, including my own response to it, to something that is evolutionarily beneficial, whether through sexual selection or some other benefit for survival.
Ornaments evolved as indicators of a potential mate's advantageous qualities, its overall health.
If my response to beauty is only about fitness and sexual selection, why can I watch the hawks outside my window forever? Why am I completely enamored of the finches coming into their color? Why do I find the bird of paradise, with whom I have no interest in entering into a reproductive relationship? Why am I completely gobsmacked by the beauty of those creatures? As I look out at the snow-capped ochres and the blooming tree outside the window, I absolutely do not believe that my aesthetic response and my pleasurable response to those two very different things give me necessarily an advantage in survival. I don't believe it. Why am I so taken with the beauty of the world when, in context, there's no reason to think that it's of any assistance to me in identifying or finding a mate, in living any longer than I do? Beauty is truth, truth beauty. And that got us decided on the topic of beauty. The irony is that we don't have a biologist as one of our keynote speakers. We're not directly addressing that question in any way in the symposium, but it's the thing that brought us to the topic. So what we're interested in is how beauty creates a motive and a framework for people's engagement with the world. And I'm going to say for people's pleasure and happiness.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Catherine Coles says the idea of the symposium this year isn't to solve beauty, but to just think about it in different ways. So they've asked a theoretical physicist to join them, and not just any physicist. The best-selling writer and physicist Brian Greene is here, along with the neuroscientist and artist Bevel Conway and the poet Claudia Rankine. We'll hear from Greene and Conway in a moment, but Catherine Coles got our conversation started with this question. What is beauty?
I think that beauty is something that exists in the space between our senses and the physical world, and in the space of our imagination, where we cultivate and consider ideas, because I think that ideas can be beautiful. So I don't want to leave that aside. But
wait, like it's a liminal space.
So I think it's a liminal space in which pleasures can be generated through our receptivity on the one hand and our effort and engagement on the other hand. And I'm just going to do a quick sideways to the philosopher Elaine Scarry, whose little book on beauty and being just my students read. And she agrees with Kant about human beauty that, well, Kant says that human beauty isn't actually beautiful because there's a goal beyond the beauty, right? And that's reproduction. You know that. And Scarry actually comes along and says, well, yeah, the whole point of beauty is that it makes you want to reproduce something. A beautiful poem makes you want to write a poem. A beautiful tree might make you want to paint it. A beautiful song makes you want to sing or write the song. I really actually disagree with her about the human. And so do my 20-year-old students who, when I ask them, when you see beautiful people, do you always immediately want to reproduce with them?
Right.
Which is a very rude question to ask your students. But they all say, no, we don't. Right. So I think that that's a mistake. I think you might want to write a poem about a beautiful person or paint a beautiful person or write a song about a beautiful person. Right. So there's that response. But the point with Scarry and the thing that I love so much about her thinking is that she believes that in the exchange between the observer of the beautiful person and the beautiful person, the act of observation elevates, energizes, ennobles the beautiful person. And the act of the receipt of that observation reciprocally ennobles and energizes the person who's looking.
And therefore it's purposeful.
And there, no, I would say
okay, so that's the question.
Not in the sense of reproduction.
Okay, so it doesn't nature won't select for that then.
Yeah, nature won't select for that.
Okay.
It's just, and she says that this is actually a moral act to observe and be energized and enlivened by the observation and to offer oneself for observation and be energized and enlivened. And I would say absent desire, wanting to reproduce, et cetera. And I actually think that this goes some way towards solving some of the problems that we have in human relationships in the world, because we live in a world right now where you're not supposed to look at beautiful people. Right?
Yeah.
That it's considered demeaning or insulting, even for people who have obviously prepared themselves to be looked at.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think that setting these questions, I think that Claudia Rankine is going to talk about beauty and power in ways that are going to be very profound in her keynote tomorrow night. But I think that in some ways, if you can set aside the idea that one of the people, either the observed or the observing, necessarily has to be more powerful in that exchange, that it actually does open, as Scarry argues, the space for a kind of justice among people. I think that's a beautiful idea.
Wow. So let me come back to the question about whether or not beauty fulfills an evolutionary purpose. So was having this conversation with our producers, and we were talking about the nature of beauty and whether or not beauty is an objective reality. And so we're looking at these flowering pear trees outside. They're really beautiful right now. And the question is, am I seeing something that is pleasurable just because of its abstract quality and objective beauty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it beautiful because it's fulfilling some kind of material purpose, even if it's just a vestigial impulse? It's it's somehow, somewhere, I find it beautiful because somehow, somewhere in my genetic line gave me the ability to reproduce. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there will be pairs.
Right. Okay.
You know, and
but that makes the argument for having a purpose.
Yeah, that makes the argument for having a purpose, absolutely. And you know, so I think the answer is yes and.
Yeah.
Hmm. Right. And it may be that we're originally primed for beauty, partly for evolutionary reasons, but I cannot think of a single evolutionary reason for me to gaze at a mountain covered with snow that, were I to give myself over to it, would probably kill me.
Yeah.
And yet, all the more beautiful the mountain that is snow-capped and forbidding. So I totally buy that I might find the pear tree more beautiful because something in me understands that that means that there will be pears. Mm-hmm. I want to argue that it's beautiful separate from that. I think that a two-year-old who has no idea yet that there will be pears will find it beautiful. You could say that that's inbred, that that's built in. But I don't think that the pear branches severed from their trunk and arranged in a vase on my counter should necessarily suggest to me that they will contribute to my survival.
Right.
And I am absolutely convinced that other species also find things attractive and beautiful that do not necessarily give them something other than that sense of wonder.
Okay, let me connect this now to poetry. One of the things you've said to your students over the years is that, and you've said to me in conversations, that there is, this is how you've put it, there's absolutely no reason for poetry to exist outside of pleasure. Explain what you mean, and let's see if we can apply it to that same idea of beauty being, yes, purposeful maybe, but also just there and beautiful.
Lyric poetry,
yeah,
of the kind that I basically live my life for, right? It does not impart a moral message. It does not give you instructions in etiquette or survival. It's not a road sign that tells you not to drive this way, but to drive this way. It's an experiential space that somebody has created and issued an invitation for anyone to enter into it and have a different experience than the one the poet had or intended, but a complex experience that's made out of these linguistic ornaments that add up to something so much bigger than that poem that's just sort of lying there dead on the page. There's no reason, Doug, for you want to read a poem except for the pleasure of dealing with the complexities, sometimes difficulties, sometimes sadnesses, sometimes joys that the poem offers.
Well, you say also that it's about opening up a potential experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reader has to agree to it.
Huh.
Right? So if I'm looking at a poem just sitting on a surface, the first thing that has to happen for that poem to be finished is for a reader actually to pick it up. And then the last thing that has to happen is for the reader to finish it.
Right.
But then the very last thing that has to happen is for the reader to carry it inside them and to be carried inside the poem for some space of time. And that is where the pleasure is. Mm-hmm. No lessons, no instructions, just wonder.
Yeah.
I think.
Can we extend that to your view of the mountain? Can we extend that to you looking to us on this team, looking at the trees? Same thing, that it doesn't have to have a message. It doesn't have to have a purpose.
I think it's a giving over.
Huh.
Right? And again, an opening to wonder. You don't come to an ultimate conclusion. The mountains I have found beautiful all my life, and I expect to continue to find them beautiful because there is no answer to that relationship.
All right, I want to have you read.
Oh.
So let's talk about this idea of beauty being in defiance of authority. Because it's another sort of spin on this question, right? Talk a little bit about it and get us into this poem, if you would.
Well, the quote is from William Carlos Williams, who is a poet I think most of us know, even from elementary school in this country. But we don't come out of elementary school knowing him as a kind of radical, right? And that his commitments in so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed by rainwater beside the white chickens are actually revolutionary,
yeah.
Right, commitments. We don't know that.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot the last few years during COVID, but even before then, about us as animals, right? About my animal commitments and my animal condition. And I think that in this quote that I use from Williams, he's asserting the freedom of the human as animal from authoritarian control and authoritarian structure. I find that a beautiful idea. So I'll read this. And the title goes right into the first line. Living wild, not being. Williams said, beauty is a defiance of authority. Feral, a falling back into arms I trust, returning to something not the same thing. Fetching, I incline to fleece and flannel, raise myself every morning and feel flight in daylight, flight refining stars or meteors, body not defined only one way. What ruffles feathers? What my mind? If I prowl free among trees and grasses or traversing the pavements, what is the catch?
All right, so let me come back to your story.
Okay.
That we started with. You're going on your run, you're listening to this, and it occurs to you throughout this piece, the question is, why do I care about beauty, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So maybe we've already answered this, but why do you care about beauty?
Because it's the thing that makes my life more than eating, working, and sleeping.
Catherine Coles, she's a poet and a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. She co-directs the university's Science and Literature Symposium, which is happening this week. It's free, open to the public. You can find a link to the event on our website, radiowest.org. This week on the campus of the University of Utah, you have a physicist, a neuroscientist, and a poet discussing beauty. It's the latest subject of a symposium at the school where they take these basic concepts like choice and imagination and beauty, and they ask people from different disciplines, not necessarily connected to the concept, to think about it and to talk about it. Brian Greene is at the symposium this year. He's speaking later today. He's a theoretical physicist and author of a number of best-selling books, among them Until the End of Time. And Greene told us, as a physicist, beauty is rooted in the physical world.
I think the overall definition or sensibility of beauty is the very fact that we're made of the same stuff as everything else, like rocks and chairs. We're made of the same particles, the same ingredients. We're governed by the same laws. And yet, when our ingredients are configured in just the right way, we human beings are able to gain self-awareness, and we're able to begin to understand the external world. And within that understanding, we begin to see these patterns, these wondrous patterns that govern motion, that govern physical behaviors. And to me, if I was really forced to give a definition of beauty, it'd be right there. It would be the fact that collections of particles governed by the very same laws of physics as everything else in the world somehow can gain this capacity to gain insight into the nature of the external world and the nature of the internal world. That to me is, in essence, where it all sits.
You write about how moral judgment and the things we see as transcendent are things that we've invented, in the sense that, like, natural selection has shaped our sense of value. It's shaped our sense of morality. Did it also shape our sense of beauty? Do you think of it in that way as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. In a number of ways that you can interpret that statement. I mean, one way is that there is no notion of beauty out there in the abstract universe. There's no notion of any of these concepts because, as you noted, they are all human invention. And it's wonderful, and might I say beautiful, that we can invent these concepts, including the very concept of beauty itself. So right there, as evolution shaped our particular physical form, it endowed us with this capacity. But we can go a little bit further, as many evolutionary psychologists have. There is evolutionary utility, evolutionary value to the very notion of beauty. If beauty holds our attention, and if there is survival value in our attention being held by one thing or another, then right there, there's an evolutionary reason why we have this sense of being drawn to the beautiful. Others have gone in the direction of beauty is what helps us get mates. And so in the most concrete sense, evolution is leveraging the capacity of us to judge. Perhaps beauty in some sense is connected to health and fitness. And so perhaps we're drawn to mates that give us that sense of beauty because from an evolutionary perspective, it gives our progeny a leg up in the relentless battle for survival. So that's a very concrete way in which some conception of beauty may intertwine with the notion of evolution by natural selection and the need for survival. So from a philosophical standpoint and from a very nuts and bolts Darwinian perspective, the connection between evolution, natural selection, and beauty is right there.
But how do you respond to those who say, but it doesn't count if we're built this way? Like, you're not a believer in free will, for example. So what does it mean that our moral appraisals are dictated by nature, which is dispassionate? Does it mean morality – you've had to sort of respond to this question. Is morality absent then if it's dictated by nature? Or just another abstract principle, aesthetics. Is that not as legitimate because it didn't spring from something other than, you know, the physical constituents that make us up, as you've said?
Yeah, I sort of see it in the reverse. I mean, there's some who feel that what really makes some conception of morality or some conception of beauty have its greatest power and sort of its most transcendent quality is if it does transcend us, quite literally, if it is out there in the universe and somehow we're tapping into some larger force that has notions of right or wrong, good and evil, beauty within it. Somehow that feels to us bigger and more important. But I see it quite the opposite. I find it utterly miraculous that these mechanical beings called human beings, again, governed by the same laws, made of the same stuff as, you know, my teacup sitting here on my desk, we nevertheless can invent an idea of right and wrong, good or evil or beauty. And the fact that we can do that, to me, makes it more intrinsic to us. It makes it not something that is being bestowed upon us from something in the external world, but it's something that we're generating. And because it's coming from us, to me, that makes it more human. To me, that makes it more intrinsically part of what it means to be human, namely that we can create these ideas. And so the fact that it's ultimately mechanical and ultimately coming from laws of physics and ingredients, just acting out the dictates of those laws, adds beauty and wonder to it for me, as opposed to somehow diminishing it, which I can certainly see where people are coming from. But I think if you dig in deeply and really imagine a universe where these ideas don't even exist, and then we humans come up with the ideas, it's that to me is thrilling.
I wonder if this can apply to animals, not human animals. That is because you write about how human activity is this, you know, in the book you describe it as this commingling of these, you know, we have these behavioral tendencies that commingle with this, you know, our self-reflexive minds, and we get to this point over time where we shift our vantage point. We have larger perspective, which gives us, I imagine, an appreciation, an understanding of beauty that comes from that larger perspective. But I was on a hike the other day and I saw a mule deer. And because I was thinking about this, I'm like, does a mule deer experience beauty? Maybe not in the same way, but how do you think about that question?
Well, I think there's actually data on this. I mean, of course, it's, as you say, a little bit difficult to know what's going on inside the mind of some other creature. In fact, the truth of the matter is you don't really know what's going on inside my mind, nor do I know what's going on inside of your mind. So we're in the dark when it comes to other minds, whether they're human or non-human animals. But let's put that to the side for a second. But yes, there are definitely studies where various animals are drawn to, their attention is held more captive by certain patterns in the external world. And it doesn't take an enormous leap of insight to imagine that they are experiencing something to do with beauty. I mean, you know, the dance of the bowerbird as it's trying to attract its mate, and it builds these very elaborate structures as a means of trying to pull in a mate. It feels like the bird is making art, making beauty, and in some sense is using that to attract a mate. So it's, again, difficult, as I said, to with precision say what's going inside the mind of an animal or a creature, but it feels resonant with the kinds of behaviors and reflections and internal experiences that we have. And so if we anthropomorphize just a little bit, we can certainly imagine that this conception applies much more broadly than to the human animal.
How much has beauty influenced your work as a physicist? That is, has it have you had to apply when you were maybe stuck on a concept? There was something like abstract, like aesthetics or beauty, that helped you come to an answer. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, I would say, unfortunately, a huge amount has been driven. And you might say, well, like, why unfortunate? Because, you know, we're all familiar with the quotes of Einstein, you know, about the beauty of the universe. And yes, and I feel that, and it's also so vital. But what we really ultimately want is that it is observation and experiment that guides how we develop our theoretical understanding. In the absence of data, in the absence of observations and experiments, we have to rely upon something else. And that something else often is a sense of elegance and a sense of beauty in the mathematics. And we say, let's not go that direction because that feels somehow mathematically awkward or clunky. Let's go in the other direction because that feels mathematically beautiful and streamlined and coherent and elegant. And so oftentimes our intuition and where we go in our theoretical research is guided by these ideas of beauty. But like I say, I really wish that we were at a point that some of our theories could be tested. I mean, the problem is the things that I work on and my colleagues, it's just so far beyond the reach of any experimental technology that we have access to today, that we're left in the dark on that front. And being left in the dark on the observational front, the experimental front, we often do rely on these kinds of decisions and insights that come from an intuitive sense of what's beautiful, what's elegant.
If you're a physicist, what's the thing in your work that's beautiful? Is it a photo of the universe? Is it a theorem? Is it a sketch of something? Like, what's the thing that's aesthetically pleasing for you?
Well, it really can be all of the above. Yeah. And I think obviously some of those are easier to grasp for the general person than others. I think all of us can marvel at a beautiful James Webb Space Telescope image of the cosmos.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just so immediately appealing to us because we feel connected to this large, wondrous external world. But the less easy to understand ones are really the beauty within the mathematical equations themselves. When I look at Einstein's field equations, which is a collection of symbols, I could rattle it off, you know, R mu nu minus a half G mu nu R equals 8 pi G over C to the fourth T mu nu. Okay, sounds like this mouthful of Greek symbols. But the point is, when I look at that equation, I see within it curved space and warped time and how they conspire to yield the gravitational force a la Albert Einstein. And so within that, I see such organization and such coherence and so much physical phenomenon embodied by just a few symbols on the page. And that fills me with a certain sense of beauty. It feels deeply aesthetic that so much can be summarized in such a simple, clear, sharp mathematical sentence. That's where that kind of beauty comes from.
Let me ask you one more thing. You write in the book that you think one day scientists are going to be able to provide a mathematically complete sense, articulation of all the processes that underlie anything that happens, you know, anywhere. And I wonder if that applies to beauty, that we'll have a more discrete sense of what aesthetics is, how it's processed, all of those kinds of things. You think that's coming? And is that going to change our sense of how we experience beauty?
Some would hear that and recoil, right? It's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, don't find the formula for beauty.
Yeah.
You're going to flatten it. You know, you're going to somehow take away the mystery of it. And I in no way think that has to be the way things turn out, even if we do make the progress that allows us to describe in more rigorous mathematical terms the kinds of experiences that we have. I mean, ultimately, the feeling of beauty is some physical process inside the human brain and human body. That's why we experience it. And if we understood all of the detailed microphysical and microbiological, microchemical processes that were going on, in some sense, we would be able to articulate that experience in the language of mathematics. But that, to me, would only add to our sense of this word, beauty or aesthetics or elegance. It would add a layer that would be right down there at the rock bottom physical description of what's going on. That would not in any way diminish the high-level human experience, that sense of awe when you look at a Picasso or a Rembrandt or you hear Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. That human experience will always be there. And if we can understand it a little better, that won't take away from the mystery and wonder of it. It will just add. How could it be, we will say, that those physical processes that we now understand so well, how is it they yield this human experience? And I think that element will always remain part of the mystery, that human experience of whatever work, and that to me is the part that will never be diminished, no matter how deep our understanding becomes.
Brian Greene, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Brian Greene, He's the director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. Among his books is Until the End of Time. He's in Utah this week, participating in the University of Utah's Science and Literature Symposium. He'll be giving the keynote address this evening. It's free. It's open to the public. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We're talking about beauty today, which is the subject of a conference on the campus of the University of Utah. Bevel Conway is a visual artist, but also a neuroscientist. He has a particular interest in the way the brain perceives color. And Conway doesn't think when the sciences break down the mechanics of how things like wonder or beauty work, that they're necessarily taking away the magic.
I think that science is an amazing lens that sort of holds you still for a little minute, gives you another way of appreciating and enriching your experience. I don't see it as this bludgeon that gets rid of the joy. I see it as exactly the opposite. I'm reminded actually of an experience I had when I was a kid. My dad, who was very interested in wine, would take us on these wine tours. I was in high school at the time. And I remember listening to this fellow tell us how he made wine, you know, and it was all the process of, you know, harvesting the grapes and crushing them and the way they were fermented and stored in these casks and the whole business. And there was this before and after moment where I'd tried as a 16-year-old or something, a sip of wine. And then I heard this guy tell this story. And then afterwards, I was like, wow, this is just such a different experience now. I feel like I can actually engage with the mystery of what it is to be wine. I tasted things I'd never even, you know, knew existed in the wine. And I see science in the same way as a way of sort of arresting your attention for a minute and giving you another language or another opportunity to reinterrogate your experience, not to dispel it, not to get rid of it, but to enrich it.
So I hope this doesn't sound like a dopey question, but it comes to my mind, like, which came first for you, wanting to be an artist or wanting to be a scientist? And I guess let me put it this way. Did you see beauty in the world and want to make sense of it as a scientist, you know, understand how it worked? Or did you already learn the way the brain, or were learning the way the brain was transforming sense data into behavior, and that made you want to make art? What came first for you?
Oh, very definitely making art came first. And I think for most people, it's the sort of experiential. You know, you're given a tub of watercolors as a little kid and you splash them around and you watch the paints meld one into the other. You have this like almost godlike feeling of creation. You're like, oh my God, I took blue paint and yellow paint and I made this whole other new thing that nobody's ever thought of before. Green paint, you know, it's like wild.
Yeah.
I think the question of beauty really only came much later. I don't think you know, beauty figured into it. It was just sort of awe. Like, wow, that's neat. Weird. How did that happen? That was the thing that captivated my attention as a kid. And then through high school, when I became quite obsessed making art, it was just, I mean, it's just amazing that you can sit down with these materials that look nothing like a finished painting or drawing, you know, like sticks of crayon and paper, and you can turn them into something that, you know, that carries an idea that changes the way you experience the world, that sticks in your memory, that, you know, infects you in a way that, you know, that the raw materials just didn't before. That's, I think it's a pretty cool feeling.
Is there any difference between that feeling and the impulses that made you want to be a scientist?
I think the timing is slightly different.
Yeah.
The resources that you need in order to do science is a sort of higher entrance barrier, as it were. But the general idea is that the sort of motivation is very similar. You know, I often think of artists as scientists in the studio. They're running little experiments, sometimes not so little, you know, and their experiments are, if I do this and I do this, what will happen? you know, if I mix this and this and I put it over here, or if I break these things and I stitch them up like this, what will it look like? And that's the same impulse that motivates most of the scientists, you know, I know and like. You know, it's a kind of process of experimentation, of trial and error, of seeing what works. And in both cases, you know, in my case as a visual artist and as a visual neuroscientist, the goal is the same, is to try and understand something about how perception and cognition work. How does vision work? How does visual thinking work?
How do you respond to the question of what is beauty?
I think beauty today has become a kind of Rorschach test that people, depending on their backgrounds or their predilections or so on, use the term in different kinds of ways.
Yeah.
And popular culture has taken the term and essentially oftentimes reduced it to just kind of pleasure. Oh, that's beautiful. That gives me pleasure. Mm. It took me a while to realize that, you know, the quest to understand something often begins with a definitional thing, like we'll define it. This is, scientists love to do this.
Yep.
We'll define it. And if you can't define it, then, you know, the conclusion is, well, you don't have a thing to study. And it took me a while to realize that that question, defining it, is really the end of the enterprise. It's the end goal. It's not the beginning. You know, and oftentimes we use that sort of challenge, define beauty, as a almost like a squid ejecting ink to shut down the conversation and cloud it rather than actually, you know, explore it. So I've come to appreciate that the term itself, in its sort of Rorschachness, in its multifaceted, in the different ways in which it is used, that itself is revealing about maybe this underlying thing. And maybe if we engage with the different ways in which people think about beauty or have used beauty as a term historically, we can enrich our own experience and understanding of ourselves, how our brains work.
There's this article written in the Scientific American by this neuroscientist team that has interested you. And they explore what they call the neurology of aesthetics. And I wanted to ask you a little bit. One of the questions that they get at in the piece is they ask whether or not there is a language – well, an innate grammar of aesthetics that we all share. Whether or not there's this universal sensibility that we all have baked into us for beauty, for aesthetics. Now, they think there may be, and I'll ask you about some of the ideas they have, but what do you think about that question?
I think that the idea, the notion that there is a universal grammar of aesthetics is a notion that comes out of our experience. You know, I speak English, and it's the language I was raised with. And I have this conviction that English makes sense because I can communicate with my friends and my kids and my spouse through English. If I confront someone who doesn't speak English, my reaction is confusion. Like, why? Why don't you? I mean, I'll just speak louder because you surely must be able to speak English. It's almost like part of the experience of having a language is the conviction that everybody must understand you. And it's only through culture and diversity and, you know, meeting different people and traveling the world where you really start to get a sense that, you know, that experience of having language is disconnected from the mechanics of how language operates.
Yeah.
That language doesn't come innately in you. You know, we don't come born speaking English. We come born maybe with the substrate to be able to speak a language, but whatever language it happens to be depends on our culture and our environment. And I would take the same tack in addressing beauty. I think maybe we all come equipped with the substrate or the impulse to have an effective response that we call beauty. But the thing that effective response is attached to, I don't think that thing is prescribed in our genes innately. And of course, I like that idea because it turns the brain not into this inevitable, you know, unfolding according to some prescribed set of rules, but it actually makes it adaptive. And I think it's through its adaptability that things like beauty then become captivating and representative of the power of human cognition.
How has your understanding of how color works How has that influenced the way you think about all of this? You write about how color kind of epitomizes the challenge of understanding vision, and it's a powerful tool for understanding how we take in information. So how does your work on color help sort of inform the way you're thinking about all of this?
I think a lot of people think about color as, you know, some kind of trivial, low-level stimulus feature, at least in our business of visual neuroscience. It's like, well, I can see faces and I can navigate environments. I can do all of this stuff in black and white. So color's basically irrelevant. And I think that misses the boat because, you know, there's a difference between my iPhone screen when it's on grayscale mode and my iPhone screen when it's on color mode. Like, yeah. One of them I really much prefer. So I think for me, color has been a very useful tool, as you've described it there, because it allows us to understand in mechanistic terms, you know, wavelengths of light. And then on the other hand, experiential terms like that, really, that's so beautiful. You know, we can kind of try and connect those dots.
Matisse said, you've pointed this out, Matisse said that an artist should wait, I think, for years before they actually touch color.
Right.
What did he mean?
I mean, I hesitate to crawl too much into Matisse's head, but I think Matisse is one of the great colorists of the 20th century.
Yeah.
You know, when I got deep into Matisse, I went back to his early work, and you can see the struggle where he's trying to understand color. He's trying to understand the kind of affective response it has and understand color as a language that he can deploy to pull at your heartstrings and sort of guide you through a painting as where color is the visual element that carries the weight of the painting. You know, Matisse was really trying to have color do all of this very heavy work in a painting. And I think in many cases, very, very successfully, to the point where people almost take it for granted. I used to teach this vision and art course for undergraduates at Wellesley College, and it was a lot of fun. And one of the exercises I had them do was, you know, make a colorful painting. What I found striking about it is how garish and hideous the paintings were that we all made when we were trying to make colorful paintings. And then we'd go and we'd look at a catalog of Matisse's paintings, and I'd say, how would you describe them? And they'd say, well, they're colorful. And then we'd sort of look at them and kind of scrutinize me like, well, they are colorful, but actually there's a lot of restraint.
Yeah. And like, space, and just space, right?
And space, yeah. Yes. He's holding back. It's masterful.
So what does that say about our perceptions of things that are beautiful? That I guess it gets to the idea of we need to sort of really think deeply about the way we're perceiving these things in some way and be more thoughtful in the way we're thinking about these things.
I think that's true. I also think that it gives us, the viewer, your brain, some agency.
Huh.
What artists are often doing is creating puzzles that are only completed by a viewer. And that makes the viewer an integral part of the medium of making the work. That completes the social cycle where art is this dialogue between the maker and the viewer, and it can't exist without that dialogue.
Bevel Conway, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It's Bevel Conway. He's an artist, a neuroscientist, and a senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. He's in Utah this week. He's going to be giving a keynote address tomorrow morning as part of the University of Utah's Science and Literature Symposium. You can find a link to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas or comments or feedback, you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.